Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 10. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, me and my guest Nick Sauer are looking at 1984's The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Through the Eighth Dimension, and also doing a retrospective on Babylon 5, the TV series that ran from 1994 to 1998. So sit back, and we're going to have a little bit of fun doing that.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 10. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I have a guest, Nick Sauer from the East Coast. I'm not sure which part of the East Coast you are, Nick.
That would be New Jersey.
Okay, fair enough. I've been there. I've actually been in New Jersey. I've been to Wayne, New Jersey once upon a time.
Oh, yeah. See, it's up north of me, actually.
Yeah, it's basically a shopping center with a few houses around it.
That's a pretty accurate description, yeah.
Yeah, but so basically what we're going to be doing here this time around is Buckaroo Banzai across The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension from 1984. And also we are going to be looking at Babylon 5. We'll do a bit of a TV series because you're a big TV series buff. And we'll do Babylon 5 this time around.
Cool. Awesome.
Okay, cool. So what have you been watching lately?
I've been going through Lost Girls, this Canadian series that Sci-Fi Channel picked up. It's going to season 3. Shortly, and I'd heard about it, but had not seen it before. So I started watching it because it was available on Netflix. And I got to say, I was kind of blown away by it. It's pretty neat film, TV series, considering it's the one of these, you know, secret fantasy world around you format shows. But it works really well. So
absolutely, yeah. I've seen I think the first season of it.
Yeah, the first season.
Yeah, but Sal watches it, but I've kind of got too many things at the moment that I'm watching. So far this year, I've actually watched 25 movies.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah, let's see. I'll only go through the genre ones I've watched, and then you can drop it with anything else you've been watching. Buckaroo Banzai, of course, we've seen that. I saw the first part of that stupid Atlas Shrugs thing, the one based on the Ayn Rand novel. Very bad movie. It looks like it's been made by people who have never seen a movie in their life. I don't recommend it at all. I did see an interesting TV movie from 1970 called The Love War with Angie Dickinson and Lloyd Bridges in it, where they play aliens fighting out a battle on the Earth.
Oh, okay, weird. I've never heard of that. The Love War?
Yeah, The Love War from 1970. It's got them in it. He's playing an alien from one species, she's playing an alien from another, and they're battling and things like that. Actually, I shouldn't have said she was an alien, because that's a spoiler. What the fuck? See the thing anyway.
TV movie, you said?
TV movie. I think Aaron Spelling had something to do with it, if I recall correctly. And basically, all the aliens are chasing each other around places like Bakersfield in California and stuff like that. It looks like it was done on a fairly low budget. Special effects are about what you'd expect from 1970 television, but interesting little piece from almost an archaeological point of view.
That sounds good. I gotta check that out.
Yeah, it is around if you know certain subterranean places to find it. You should be able to catch a copy of that. Let's see what else. Jack the Giant Killer with Kerwin Matthews. I saw that as well, which has got some Jim Danforth stop motion giants and dragons and things like that on it.
That was a George Pal film, right? Was that?
I don't believe it was. It's very much in the same kind of genre as George Pell stuff.
I get confused about that stuff, yeah.
I saw the 1988 The Blob, which is kind of why I bother remaking The Blob. Let's see what else.
We're stunning on that, though, I got to say.
Yeah, the effects were pretty good, too. Little bits and pieces, but you know, in general, nothing much. I watched Nightwatch again. Have you seen the Russian fantasy film Nightwatch?
No, I have not gotten to it yet. I've heard really good stuff about it.
Yeah, I kind of like it too. If you can, be careful. There's a few different versions out there on DVD and Blu-ray. The version I originally got was the first US one on DVD, and it's shorter, and there are a whole bunch of subplots that are missing from it. But the Blu-ray version's got the whole lot on it. Maybe there's a later version that has a whole lot on it, but much more interesting with the extra subplots. It kind of fills out a lot of the gaps and helps you bridge that cultural gap between a Russian movie and our Western sensibilities in that way.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. So thanks for the heads up on that.
Yep. And I saw Dredd, the 2012 Judge Dredd movie with Carl Urban in it. Let me see. What do I think about it? I think it had some very, very good guns.
Uh-huh.
I can't recommend anything else about it.
Oh, really? I thought it worked from... I guess... My complaint with it was that with the visual effects limitations, you couldn't do Mega City 1 like they did in the Stallone movie, which I really thought captured Mega City 1 nicely. But I thought once you got into the building, it was a fairly standard Judge Dredd story, and you know, if you're into it, that's fine. But I enjoyed it. I got something out of it. But,
yeah. I mean, it's nothing you haven't seen before in other films in a way, but it kind of reminded me a lot of the Raid Redemption, if you've seen that. The Indonesian kind of action flick from a year or two ago.
Yeah, okay.
If you haven't seen that, I recommend it. It's fantastic.
Okay.
But anything else you've seen?
Buckaroo Banzai, obviously. My wife just got me for Christmas the Universal Monster set on Blu-ray, the classic Universal Monster set. So I watched.
I've got that one too.
Yeah, I watched the Spanish version of Dracula finally because while it was available on the computer, I really dislike watching stuff on my computer.
Mm. And do you think it's better than the Lugosi one? I mean, there's an argument for it being better than the Lugosi one.
I think it is slightly. First of all, there's 30 extra minutes of material, so you get a lot more. There's a little more depth of character development stuff. But I think the balancing factors for me on it were that, you know, Lugosi as Dracula is obviously pretty awesome. Mm. But the guy who plays Dracula in the Spanish one is serviceable. He's not he's serviceable. He's certainly not Lugosi. But the other actors in the movie are spectacular compared to the counterparts in the American film. I think that's what really sort of elevates the film a little bit above the U.S. version. It's all the other actors really carry their roles much better, I felt.
Yeah, good observation that. Didn't they film it at nighttime after Lugosi and the American crew went home or something like that on the same sets?
Yeah, and actually using the same marks too, actually. They had an interview with the actress who played, I think Maria was her name in the Spanish film. And she was saying that they actually use the same marks and everything for the scenes.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like that thing they did in a lot of European films in the 50s and 60s, where they'd film the safe version, and then they'd film the bit with all the actresses naked.
Yeah, I always got a laugh out of that. I always thought that.
Yeah, and people are scrambling around trying to find the one where the actresses are naked these days when they go searching for the films. It's just that little extra bit of fun for the people who are aware of it kind of thing. But anything else to see? Well, I saw one other thing which is kind of stupid, and I'll tell you why it's stupid. I saw Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, which had Steve Carell and Keira Knightley in it. And I'm over the apocalypse. I'll be really honest with you. I am totally over apocalypses. They are starting to seriously piss me off. Here I am looking to the future and trying to get my shit together and trying to make the rest of my life a marvelous thing. And all these miserable pricks start going around destroying the world out from under me, and I don't like it that much.
That's funny. That's funny. Everyone I know who's seen it has actually been very positive on it, but I hear your complaint.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a love story. Martin Sheen comes in and you wonder why he's not in the White House. And. but there are some weird observations about how people would react to an impending apocalypse. Most of them seem to want to fuck everybody and take heroin, according to that film.
Well, yeah, if there's no long-term consequences for it, why not do it, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, we were talking about the Mayan apocalypse. Sal and I were talking about it, and she said, well, should we pay the bills? You know, we're having a discussion. Should we pay the bills? And I said, yes, for one good logical reason. Basically, if you pay it and the apocalypse happens, big deal, you can't spend the money anyway.
Right.
But if the apocalypse doesn't happen, you've then got to scramble around and find the money to pay the bills. So
right.
There's no disincentive to pay the bills if the apocalypse is about to happen. Because if there's any uncertainty about it at all, logic favors you paying your bills as you normally would.
Right.
So we kind of settled that one pretty quickly. But yeah, I really am over apocalypses. I didn't watch The Road, you know, that movie based on Frank McCormack or something.
I watched it on TV and I was I reacted very badly to it because it has this sort of pretentious. It has this pretentious thing that I really dislike in films where. They don't name anything. It's like the guy is the man, and you never learn his name. The boy is the boy. And I just, that just nails on a blackboard to me.
Yeah, it's like they're the only one in the world. He's the only boy, and he's the only man.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't like the negativity of a lot of these films where they assume everybody's going to be a total psychopath. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we know from real-life disasters, tsunamis and other things like that is that brings out the best in the majority of people. It doesn't bring out the worst.
Right, yeah, even here in New Jersey, after Sandy hit, people were actually taking care of each other, which is not, you know, behavior people would normally associate with people from New Jersey based on our reputation.
Yeah, I mean, Saturday Night Live is doing you guys a disservice pretty much every second week.
Yeah, that's it. I don't know, I kind of like our rep, so.
People were nice in New Jersey when I was there, so I haven't got a problem with it. But anyway, let's get on. What do you want to do first? Do you want to do Babylon 5 or you want to do Buckaroo Banzai? Your choice.
Why don't we do Buckaroo Banzai first, because I think we're going to have more to talk about with Babylon 5.
Yeah, that's fine. Before we do that, here's your chance to get your plug in for the blog.
Oh, thank you.
You said you're not very good at that, so I thought I'd prompt you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've got a blog called Fantastic Television. It's Fantastic Television, all one word, .wordpress.com. It's you get to see my basically twice a week ramblings on my thoughts on genre television. You can see all the stuff I'm watching, which is a lot, which is probably as much as Terry was watching movie-wise. So it's just me, you know, talking about my thoughts on various things from reviews of what I'm watching to, you know, what's currently going on and being released to, you know, just, you know, sort of historical stuff as well. I've actually got one article that was really popular. It was what I consider like the dozen or so foundation genre TV shows, like shows that really sort of established everything.
I'll have to send you a couple of links to some really shit Australian science fiction TV shows.
Oh, awesome.
that are on YouTube, and they don't bode well for the intellectual capacity of 1960s Australian television production. Things like Phoenix 5 and stuff like that, they're not good at all. But that's how it goes anyway. But yeah, I do recommend your blog, and you're doing good stuff there too. And speaking of genre television, last three episodes of Fringe are coming up. I think the third last one's just been shown in the States, and there is a double feature one coming up soon, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a show I really regret not getting into. I've got the first season on DVD, and at the time I was the reason I didn't get into it for a really stupid reason. At the time I was watching Lost with my wife, kind of got me into it, and I was like, here I was watching, I'm thinking, here's another J.J. Abrams show series. Do I really want to get into a show that has going to have all these unanswered questions and mysteries? And, you okay there, dude?
Yeah, I was just turning the light away so it's not shining at you.
Okay.
And I burnt my finger on it.
I didn't want to get into another show where, like, are they going to leave all these unanswered questions and stuff? So I said, all right, I'm just going to stop watching this now, and I probably would have been better service to stopping Lost and continuing with Fringe in retrospect.
Well, Fringe, I think, they're tying up the loose ends really nicely, and the great thing about it is the ensemble's not as large as it was for Lost, yeah. Which I never really got into, but I do know it had a large cast. And the quality of the act...
Larger, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, the quality of the actors is fantastic in Fringe. Mostly because they've got a couple of Australians.
Okay. Not that you're biased or anything.
No, well, you know, it's one of those things. We've got a tyranny of distance here. People would watch any movie Rod Taylor was in because he was Australian. Any movie Errol Flynn was in because he's Australian. So, yeah, it tends to go like that. I've got to dip this finger in some water now. So just excuse me while I get some water out and basically maintain my thumb, which I just burnt severely on a light socket, moving a light around. And I've got my thumb dipped into a glass of water now, so we can keep going. But I'm just going to monitor my thumb while we do it. Okay.
Sorry? You want to get some ice or something to be safe?
No, I've got cold water here, so it's all fine here. So you got any snow and stuff around your place at the moment?
No, actually, it's interesting. New Jersey is... You wouldn't think it's that far south compared to New York, where I'm originally from, but it's far enough south that we don't really get a lot of permanent snow.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever snowed here since about the Ice Age. I'm up in the hills about 60 kilometers away. Right. But if it ever snows here, you know that the world's probably going to end.
Yeah, you're in a world...
Well, we're in the west of Melbourne, and basically it's a whole bunch of flat old plains where there used to be volcanoes millions of years ago. In fact, well, there's a hill about 2 kilometres away that used to be a volcano.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And, now it's just kind of low hill, but if you look out across the horizon, there are a couple of old hills that used to once upon a time be active volcanoes.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I mean, we're not very volcanically active as a continent, but... what happened is, millions of years ago, of course, we were. And I only found out recently that where I live is basically on the slope of an ancient volcano.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so speaking of stuff like that and weird stuff, let's talk about the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension. I'll do the little bit of the Wikipedia blurb and then we'll have a bit of a chat.
Laugh for while you can, monkey boy.
Let's see, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, often shortened to Buckaroo Banzai, is a 1984 parody science fiction film that was directed and produced by W.D. Richter and concerns the efforts of the multi-talented Dr. Buckaroo Banzai, a physicist, neurosurgeon, test pilot and rock musician, as he tries to save the world by defeating a band of interdimensional aliens called Red Electroids from Planet 10. The film is a cross between the action, adventure, and science fiction film genres and also includes elements of comedy, satire, and romance. And the stars are Peter Weller, Ellen Barkin, John Lithgow, Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Lloyd, and a bunch of other people. So, did you see this when it first came out?
Yes, I did, actually.
Yeah, I saw it. I think I saw it on video soon after it was released in the cinemas.
Yeah, it was hard to. It was one of those things where it was hard to catch because I knew it was coming out. Actually, I don't know if they talk about it there, but they advertised the hell of it up until June, but I think Fox really didn't know understand how to market the film at all. So they suddenly, just without any notification, just pushed the release date back to August 10th. So if you've been watching the commercials on TV, you're like, well, where's this movie? And then suddenly it materializes on August 10th opposite Red Dawn. So it obviously didn't fare too well in the theater.
No, well, the budget was $17 million and it made back $6.2 million. So it was definitely a loss there. But it's one of those ones that's got a long tail too. People are buying the DVD and the Blu-ray and things like that. And people who saw it when they were young really have a fondness for it.
Yep.
And there is a video on YouTube where Kevin Smith did a retrospective on Buckaroo Banzai and interviewed Peter Weller and John Lithgow at the New York Film Festival.
Oh, really?
And they go into some of the history and the reasons why the film didn't do well. It was brought out kind of in between a regime change at Warner Brothers, where David Beagleman's people were coming in and the old regime was going out.
I heard rumors to that effect. That's good to verify that, yeah.
Yeah, they verified it, and they said that there was a lot of studio interference, particularly from Beagleman. In fact, they originally had a different director of photography, a guy called Jordan Cronenworth, who was well known for a lot of good things. He was one of the 10 best cinematographers. The Cinematographer Organization in America voted him one of the 10 best of all time. He did things like, let me have a look here through his IMDb, Blade Runner, for instance, Cutter's Way,
right.
Rolling Thunder. He did Altered States, I believe, as well. So he really good top cinematographer. There are still a couple of scenes where that he DP'd on, including the concert footage where Buckaroo Banzai and his band, the Hong Kong Cavaliers, are playing. You can tell there's a distinct difference between the cinematography in a few of those scenes and in the rest of the film, where they got some other guy in called Fred J. Konecamp, whose biggest claim to fame was he did he DP'd on things like The Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Okay.
The Swarm, Embryo. Oddly enough, he did Doc Savage's Man of Bronze. He was a DP on that as well, which is interesting because it's very much similar to Buckaroo Banzai in some ways.
Yeah, you can definitely tell Buckaroo Banzai was modeled on Doc Savage.
Yeah, it's got that kind of thing with the call it polymath genius, charismatic hero, and a whole bunch of very competent men in one or other fields.
Right, so
really. Yeah. But, I've got a couple of issues with the film, to be really honest. Watching it in retrospect, one, I'm not sure Peter Weller was the best person for the role. I think somebody with maybe a stronger persona as an actor might have been better.
It was interesting you'd mention that, and I was glad you gave me like 12 hours or so warning to think about other people, because it's funny because I've seen, I sort of viewed it from the other perspective, where I saw Peter Weller as Buckaroo Banzai, so Peter Weller was kind of always Buckaroo Banzai to me. So, but it's an interesting exercise to think of who else would be in the role. So, who did you come up with? I'm curious.
I've been trying to think of it. 1980s wasn't really good for charismatic actors in a lot of ways. I mean, if it had been 8 or 10 years later, I would have thought somebody like Clooney might have had a go at it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I always thought Clooney. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was thinking that Clooney would make a terrific Doctor Strange if they ever put him into a Marvel movie.
Oh, yeah, you would. That'd be awesome for that.
Yeah, so what were you going to say?
Oh, yeah, I had to bring my wife in for help on this. I actually stuck with, 84 in earlier actors, and I actually had to bring Diane in because she's better at this sort of stuff. I'm horrible at recasting people, roles. But she actually gave me Ed Harris, actually. Who I thought might actually stand a chance of doing it.
I could see Ed Harris doing it. There's a few different people around. The problem is that Buckaroo Banzai, the character, is supposed to be half Japanese.
Right, and it's not got the black hair, yeah.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have any hair at all.
Right.
it's a hard one to pick an actor like that. Keanu Reeves has got the right genetics for it,
right.
But I don't really think he'd be any good because he can't act.
Right. Well, it reminds me of one of my friend's lines about The Matrix. He had the biggest hurdle he had was that Keanu Reeves was supposed to be playing a smart guy, and he had real trouble because seeing him that from Bill and Ted movies.
Talking about The Matrix just for a moment and diverging a bit. One thing I've got to say about Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, he gave $1 million to the special effects people who were the main special effects people on that film out of his own pocket for what they did.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. That's
I know there's some people that got a bit of a payday out of that as well.
Oh, wow.
It was filmed in Australia. And I know a few of the people who worked incredibly long hours over incredibly long months to get those films together, and they just got this sudden windfall from Keanu, which shows that even if he isn't a good actor, I think he may be a good person.
Oh, that is. That's really nice. That's very nice. The other one came up with... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please. I'm interested to find out, please.
Dennis Quaid, actually, she thought. She mentioned this. I can kind of see that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Dennis Quaid's got the intelligence as an actor to pull it off.
Yeah.
And to get that going. But... It's really, a difficult time for actors in at that time. There weren't all these great up-and-comers.
Right, yeah. Well, all the great up-and-comers are all the other characters in the movie, to a large extent. That's the thing.
Yeah, Clancy Brown and people like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to think about that and see who else would have made a good Buckaroo Banzai at the time. It's a tough one. These days, you can probably think of a few people who could play the role. But in 84, a little bit more of a problem, I think.
Right, yeah.
I mean, looking at modern people, somebody like, let's see, Josh Brolin, maybe.
Oh, yeah, without question, yeah.
Would have made a good Buckaroo.
Really good.
Yeah, I saw him interviewed recently by Jon Stewart, and they were having a great time with it. He can play comedy, he can play the deepest drama and things like No Country for Old Men, so I think that Brolin, like his father's got a hell of a career ahead of him as well as behind him.
But
the essential problem is I think Peter Weller's great, and he said he was going to play the character in this interview that he did with Kevin Smith. He said he played the character like a cross between Jacques Cousteau and Adam Ant.
I read that he actually had a few other people in addition, and I forget who else, but those were two I remember distinctly as well.
Yeah, which Adam Ant, being a reference that probably would have died out 2 years after the movie was made.
Yeah.
As his career kind of dropped into the can. But nonetheless, it makes him very much an artifact of his time. The character of Buckaroo Banzai, as we presented it, is locked right into the 1980s.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, that explains probably why the movie, again, the other reason the movie attracted me. I liked Adam Ant back in the day, so if he was playing that would appeal to me, even though I didn't pick up on it.
Yeah. I mean, we've got Ellen Barkin in there, and that's one of the unfortunate things I found about the film, and I don't mean to diss it too much because there is a lot of cool stuff in there, but the Penny Pretty character is just there basically because there weren't enough chicks in the movie. That's my impression of it.
Yeah, it was bit of a fifth wheel, I give you that.
Yeah, she was only there to get captured and to give a love interest to the main character, which doesn't necessarily show the strongest writing there. Yes. It would have been nice to have a female character who was competent in her own field and wasn't just a chick who gets drunk in bars and tries to shoot herself.
Yes. Well, it's also the pulp-type writing, so of course she has to get captured, right? You know, that goes with the territory.
Yeah. But leaving that aside, this is one of the ones where the bad guys tend to act everybody else totally off the map.
Yes.
And John Lithgow as Lord John Warfen, alias Emilio Lozardo, with his tootsie fruitsy kind of Chico Marx accent.
Yes, they're clearly channeling El Ducey. What the hell is his name?
Mussolini. Yeah.
Mussolini. There. Yeah, that's clearly.
In fact, he did watch some of Mussolini's speeches to get that vibe about it, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But, I think I'll put that in here. I'll put in Laugh While You Can, Monkey Boy, a few times while we're talking about John Lithgow.
Laugh while you can, Monkey Boy.
Yeah.
In post-production, because that's one of the great bits and pieces. And the thing is that I think that because I was looking at John Lithgow's career at the time this was made.
Laugh while you can, Monkey Boy.
And he was doing serious things like playing a transgendered person in The World According to Garp.
Laugh while you can, Monkey Boy.
And he played a bit of a bastard in All That Jazz around the same time. And there were a couple of other films of his that were really, really strong. Let me just see. I'm looking through it.
Where are we going?
Let it
end!
He did that bit in Twilight Zone, the movie, with the role originally played by Shatner.
Yeah, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, yeah.
Yeah, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, he did that. He was in The Big Fix with Richard Dreyfuss a few years before, and he was in that other horrible disaster movie the day after, the TV movie about the nuclear war in Kansas kind of thing. Yeah. And he played the bad guy in Footloose.
Oh, that's a classic role for him. So The Day After doesn't hold up that well, in your opinion? I was going to watch it again. I've got it on DVD. I haven't gotten to it yet.
I will confess this. My theory is, I saw it once in New Zealand in 1988. They have very strong marijuana in New Zealand. Not that I've used in the last 15 years or so, but at the time I was in New Zealand, the people I was staying with chuffed. And we watched it while we were a bit stoned, and it was a bummer.
The whole movie downer from the word go.
There's no upside at the end of that film. And so I recommend, if you're going to see it, you do have to see it with a relatively unimpaired metabolism.
Okay.
That's a story for another time, but it may have affected my ability to rewatch the film. That's all I can say.
It's not my goddamn planet. Understand, monkey boy?
I like John Lithgow as an actor. I think he's got great range. I mean, he played a serial killer in Dexter recently, sure. According to Sal. Yeah.
Trinity Killer. Awesome. Best, one of the best seasons of Dexter ever. Really creepy guy.
Really. Yeah, I don't watch it myself. She's got T-shirts and all sorts of stuff from Dexter.
Oh, it's a great show.
But I do like him as an actor, and I think this is at a time when he was considered a serious actor, when he could play. Mm-hmm. And I think he ran with it to Lord John Wolfe and / Emilio Lazzardo. It was just one of the great joys of this film, along with, of course, Christopher Lloyd playing his offsider.
Yep, John Biggs.
Yeah, John Big Boutte. And there are some good other actors in there. There's Rosalind Cash is in there. She's quite good too. Carl Lumley playing John Parker, the black electroid from Planet 10, who's one of the good guys.
Yep.
And it's just got that kind of Boyzone. Are you getting some drum feedback here?
A little bit. Are you getting it at your end? Or?
Yeah, a little bit. It's like maybe the helicopters are flying over again. But, basically the movie is very much in that kind of 1980s post-punkish vibe, I think. And it was a time when there were a lot of kind of more serious science fiction films coming out. And having one that played with the genre and harked back to that Doc Savage kind of vibe, as well as getting into really bad 1980s rock music and all the other little tropes that come into it, and making fun of the government, having the president played by an English actor channeling Orson Welles in Citizen Kane, whose defense advisor is played by a Russian actor.
Yeah, I thought that was great,
Smirnoff. And those little bits, there are a whole bunch of little kind of Easter eggs in this film. For people who want to pay attention to them, that do save it from being just a kind of failure in an enjoyment sense, not necessarily in a financial sense. So, I mean, it does have a cult status.
Right.
And it is a terrible lot of fun, really.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to say about Buckaroo Banzai?
No, not really. Actually, the one thing I would say is you'd mentioned that you thought the directing was a little weak in it, and you'd mentioned it actually before I saw it again. I watched it again after that, and I would really, watching it again the second time after you said that, I would really agree that, given that, it's actually Richter's first film, first bout out directing, and his first of two actually ever times he directed, it really sort of leapt out at me on the most recent viewing that, they're directing really was a hindrance to the film, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think one of the things is with that, one of the things that Peter Weller said as well was they're bringing all the money people who were financing the studio through to watch them make the film.
Mm-hmm.
So they had it was happening every couple of days during the shoot when they were in studio. So you had that kind of pressure from the studio in a weird kind of way happening.
Micromanaging,
but also... he said one of the things is when they're filming, there's only about five or six people working at any one time.
Right.
You've got the camera people and the lighting people and whoever's running the special effects and the actors. Right. So these guys would come through and think that everybody was getting paid for doing nothing.
Right.
Whereas when they stop filming is when those guys really earn their money.
Right.
And there was a lot of that kind of pressure on there as well. But also having a first-time director on there, I don't know whether you could feel comfortable enough to take the chances and be bolder, which is what this film really required, that boldness.
Right, yeah, definitely.
Which I don't think it had. I mean, even though it is a cult favorite and things like that, I think there's an argument, and you can disagree with me if you like, on remaking it at some stage or maybe doing a TV series.
Yeah, well, they when Fox started up, I've got my wife got me, knows I really like the film, and she got me the most recent DVD release of it, and it actually has a clip in it for like computer graphics for a proposed Buckaroo Banzai series for Fox that never went anywhere, so had been examined. I don't know. It's so you're remaking it. Yeah, I'm kind of two minds on it. I don't see it as being a bad thing necessarily, but it is kind of really so unique that it's kind of scary to touch it, you know?
Yeah, but I'd like to see a series or a movie like that where you've got the genius centerpiece and a whole bunch of really cool people around him fighting the bad guys. That's one of the reasons the Avengers worked. You've got that ensemble, and which is almost built around Tony Stark in a sense.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people want that. People want that kind of thing where you've got really cool acting, really cool. I mean, special effects have got to the stage where you can do anything you want. The only limitations are your imagination.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that that would really work well. Have that format of film is something that people do want to see.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
But with recommendations, I'm not going to do a score on this one. People know it fairly well. It's a little bit out of the usual for Martian Drive-In podcast because I usually try to do obscure things. Right. But I think it's worth revisiting and reevaluating if people saw it back in the 80s or even in the 90s when it was big on VHS. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to watch between the main stuff because there's a lot of little bits and pieces in there. The Grover's Mill, New Jersey bit.
Yep.
There are some versions of it that do have the bit at the start with Buckaroo Banzai's parents.
Yeah, the film that the little Buckaroo's making the movie film. Yeah,
yeah.
That was included on that DVD as well. I actually watched that separate from the movie. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, so there was an immense amount of stuff written by Earl MacRouch. He wrote a couple of Buckaroo Banzai scenarios and built up this enormous amount of backstory and texture for the thing, which you get hints of in the film.
Right. Well, even more so, if you read the book, the novelization of it, the novel's great. It's because it's the classic pulp thing where it's like he's writing it from the perspective that I'm just documenting this real character. This guy, Buckaroo Banzai, really exists, and he's and so there's all the – and it's really – apart and in addition to that, you've got like references like where he'll say something and he'll footnote and he'll say, well, this was previously established in this Buckaroo Banzai novel, which of course doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Got this whole conceit, I guess you call it.
I did look up the novelization too. It's about $18 secondhand on eBay at the moment, so you can find it, but there's a bit of a premium on it.
Yeah, it was funny because they actually re-released it not too long ago. I've actually got both versions of it because I actually bought
Okay, now you know what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to look up Amazon.com. Give me a moment.
Sure.
See if I see.
Not for while you can, monkey boy.
Okay, but yeah, I mean, I kind of like. I'm getting this weird thing where I'm collecting novelizations and movie tie-ins for things that I like. The radio gig I do up in the Northern Territory, Ivor, the guy I do with ABC, also runs a store. And he keeps getting movie tie-in books from the 40s, 50s, and 60s and sends them to me. So I keep getting all these weird movie tie-ins from obscure 1940s movies and things like that, which is a lot of fun. Okay, let's have a look here. Movies, books, Buckaroo Banzai. And this is fascinating for everybody but me. Let's have a look here. It's $17.13 on Amazon.com. And, so you can get copies on Amazon, which is a lot less than
It's got the movie cover on it, right? That's the one.
Yeah, it's got Peter Weller playing guitar while John Lithgow scowls at him from the left-hand side of the page. So you can get them used for as little as $5.74. So there you go. People can find them if they want to.
Yeah.
But, add it to your collection. Like, I don't have enough stuff around here, as you can see behind me. to keep me busy. But, yeah, so Buckaroo Banzai, recommended, but I think one of the mind games you can really have is finding out, thinking for yourself how they might have made it better.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll take a tiny break now, and when we get back, we'll probably ramble on endlessly about Babylon 5, all five seasons of it.
Not for while you can, monkey boy.
And we're back. Now, before we talk about Babylon 5, I forgot something. I normally do some news from the planet Mars, he said, picking up the pieces of paper that fell on the ground. There is some news about the planet Mars, which is kind of interesting.
Here is the breaking news from the planet Mars.
So Mars One, a non-profit organization based in the Netherlands, is going to want to establish a human settlement on Mars in 2023. They released the application criteria. Among the other virtues you've got to have are, must have a deep sense of purpose, a willingness to build and maintain healthy relationships. You must have the capacity for self-reflection and the ability to trust. You've got to be resilient, adaptable, curious, creative, and resourceful. And you've got to be at least 18 years old. Now, I'm at least 18 years old, so I fulfill that. There's no maximum age set.
Huh.
Let's see. The selection process will begin during the first half of 2013. And they're turning it into a reality TV show. So rather than being voted off the island, you're voted onto the planet.
Oh, okay. There you go. So it's like it actually reminds me of Fox had a pilot for a show called Virtuality that was an interstellar journey that was financed because they financed it by making it like a reality TV show where they had cameras on the crew and stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit like that, which is kind of from. They've got an introductory film on YouTube as well. But I'm just trying to find out if there's anything else cool about this.
Being immune to cosmic radiation was kind of not on the list of things you need to have to go to Mars there.
Yeah, a family history of not getting melanomas from the sun is probably the one too. But, yeah, I mean, Mars wouldn't be too bad. You're one-third the weight, so everybody doesn't have to worry about that. Elon Musk is also doing one. The guy that has put Tesla cars together, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Is planning his own Mars mission as well. And there was a bit of a fuss this week because he wanted to get vegetarians only because, you know, the food being, you'd be eating mostly vegetables and things like that. So he said he was going to try to recruit vegetarians to go to Mars. And everybody who loved bacon got pissed off with Elon Musk until he put a retraction through on Twitter. So, but nothing against people who eat meat. It's just going to be bloody difficult to get pigs to Mars. But, yeah, I mean, Mars is definitely on everybody's sights at the moment. They're actually looking seriously at what would be required to get people there and things like that. And, of course, the Curiosity rover doing interesting things up there has really sparked a lot of people's imaginations.
Yeah, Curiosity is awesome to watch with the stuff they're getting
from
Curiosity.
Absolutely. So you're going to put your application in?
I think my wife would probably have issues with that, actually. So I think I'll pass it for the moment.
Well, yeah, I did do a plus and minus for myself on this. I mean, the minuses are pretty big. Really big.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, 20 minutes to get a Google search done. Coffee would be the other one.
Oh, you'd live on that stuff, do you?
Well, yeah, I do like having my morning espresso shot, so... it'd be damn difficult to get out. I mean, if I had personal luggage, mine would mostly be a Kindle full of pornography and coffee beans. But, yeah, so it's going to be kind of interesting.
I hear you on the pornography.
There'd be an argument for riding a 50 Shades of Grey once you got to Mars and then making a fortune back on Earth, flogging off 50 Shades of Mars. Yeah, that'd work, yeah. Martian pornography, next big thing after clown porn, yeah.
That's right.
Anyway, on to Babylon 5. While we're on space, we'll get to Babylon 5. Now, I'll just do a little bit of a montage of Babylon 5 audio. It does tend to the bombastic, but it does set things up nicely.
It was the dawn of the third age of mankind, 10 years after the Earth-Minbari War. The Babylon Project was a dream-given form. Its goal, to prevent another war by creating a place where humans and aliens could work out their differences peacefully. It's a port of call, home away from home for diplomats, hustlers, entrepreneurs, and wanderers. Humans and aliens wrapped in 2,500,000 tons of spinning metal, all alone in the night. It can be a dangerous place, but it's our last best hope for peace. This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2258. The name of the place is Babylon 5. The Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace. A self-contained world 5 miles long, located in neutral territory. A place of commerce and diplomacy for 250,000 humans and aliens. A shining beacon in space, all alone in the night. It was the dawn of the third age of mankind, the year the Great War came upon us all. This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2259. The name of the place is Babylon 5.
Okay, Babylon 5. It's nearly 20 years old now. It's actually 19 years old at its oldest. I think the pilot was produced about 20 years ago. It's a TV series that I think was done by Warner Brothers at the time, from what I can see.
Yeah.
Between 1994 and 1998. It's an American space opera. The blurb from IMDb is nice and concise on this. A space station in neutral territory is the focus of a unique 5-year saga. That doesn't say anything. But basically, it's set about 200 years in the future, and set between 2258 and 2262. And it depicts a future where Earth has sovereign states and under a unifying Earth government. Colonies within the solar system and beyond make up the Earth Alliance, and they've met a bunch of aliens. There are a great number of alien species in Babylon 5. Even just off the top of my head, I mean, you've got the Centauri, you've got the Minbari, you've got the Narn, you've got the Drazi, you've got the Vorlons, you've got the Shadows. You've got a whole bunch of different species, some of which are humanoid, but some of which are very not humanoid. And there's a 5-year story arc here, which was kind of this is one of the first series that really embraced that long series arc rather than doing very much episodes where things get set back to where they started.
The reset button, yeah. It really, really pioneered that whole storytelling, you know, one continuous story idea.
Yeah, and they escalate things really, really well. It starts out where the species and the people on Babylon 5, and in the first season they had Commander Geoffrey Sinclair, played by Michael O'Hare. Now, Michael O'Hare died recently, and I don't mean to diss anyone, but there were some problems with him as an actor. He was a bit wooden.
Yes, I would
and
agree.
So some problems with certain chemicals that are inserted nasally, from what I heard.
Oh, I had not heard about that part of the story. Okay.
It was a medical problem the guy had. I mean, I always consider drug problems to be medical problems, so he had a medical issue there with a dependency.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate, but he does have a comeback. He's in the first season, and then his character gets reallocated to the Minbari homeworld as an ambassador or as some kind of liaison person. But he does come back in a very interesting way later in the series, but I'm not going to do any spoilers on it. But this is a big story, and it does hit some really big issues.
Yeah.
So just your impression of it, what's your memory of it, and what do you like about Babylon 5 as a series?
Well, yeah, my memory of it is, just to put it a little bit of context historically, when it came out, when you talked about space genre TV series in the U.S., you were basically talking Star Trek. And Star Trek was really at the top of its game right in '93. You had Next Gen. You know, they're going into Deep Space Nine, the movie. So, you know, it was really, you know, Star Trek was the model of what people considered space opera for television to be. And in comes this show, Babylon 5, and, you know, really bold as brass, gets in your face that not only is it not Star Trek, it really gets in your face about it not being Star Trek. You know, everything's different. The aliens don't like you. Some of the aliens genuinely don't like each other, as opposed to the big friendly Federation. And just the whole thing, like we said, where this is, as Straczynski said, it's a 110 chapter novel, as opposed to every at the end of every episode, bang, the reset button gets hit, and we're back to, you know, the happy crew and, you know, ships in one piece and stuff like that.
Yeah, and one of the other things too is that in one of the things that differentiates it from Star Trek very much so is in Babylon 5, humans are the newbies in space.
Yes, 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 that was great.
Yeah, and even where we're not the particularly always the newbies, we're there trying to build communities, and Babylon 5 is set up as a kind of neutral meeting place for all the species to sort things out. And as the story arc continues, particularly ramping it up in the second series when John Sheridan, played by Bruce Boxleitner, comes aboard, there are a number of different things that really ramp up the drama, one of which is the fact that there are older races out there that are fucking people and species up.
Yep.
There's the Shadows and the Vorlons, who were elder races and have their own agendas, which aren't necessarily agendas that serve the other races. And then you've got a problem with...
And they're also very secretive about their... They're not really upfront about those agendas either.
They tend to work through other people and through other species.
Right.
Which is one of the big things. And then you've also got the other story arc, which is major, about surreptitious coup d'etat on Earth, right, where the president is killed,
right,
and the vice president takes over.
Clark takes over.
Yeah, and Earth has telepaths. I mean, they have the Psi-Corps.
Yeah, which is telepaths have been shoved into that box called Psi-Corps. It's like... It's really unpleasant scenario in that you're taking all these people with these special powers and stuffing them in this little box and, you know, just hoping nothing bad will happen, kind of, you know.
And Psi-Corps has its own agendas, and EarthGov has its own agendas, and Babylon 5, because it was set up as a neutral point and because of the humans and the aliens involved on it, tends to be the buffer between the warring elder species and also EarthGov's agenda with regard to the xenophobia about the other species.
Right. Well, yeah, I got the distinct impression that the whole thing with Clark setting up his regime was sort of centered around that xenophobia. I mean, was that correct in viewing it that way, or?
Yeah, I mean, the Earth-Minbari War had been about 10 years before, and the Minbari were right on Earth's doorstep.
Right.
And stopped and surrendered.
Yeah, sued for peace, yeah, surrendered and sued for peace.
They sued for peace. And a lot of humans who had fought in that war, of course they had families who died in the war as well, don't understand why, and they're basically terrified by the fact that they were losing, and suddenly everything stopped.
Right.
And it's not something that particularly the more aggressive male human beings were able to encompass it and embrace.
Yeah.
And they don't know why it happened. They don't trust the Minbari, even though the Minbari have kind of acted honorably since then. The whole war was caused by basically an error.
Right.
And
contact that went really south, which...
Yeah, a totally screwed up one where the Minbari president was killed almost by accident, and they basically went from there. They sued for peace, they formed an alliance, and Babylon 5 is very much part of that. But one of the other things that differentiates this series from Star Trek is the fact that other species get a lot of airtime. I mean, in Star Trek, you tend to concentrate a lot on the Earth and those kind of cardboardy species like the Klingons and the Romulans and the people and the Vulcans, who have got one or two character traits. They're not nuanced to the way that the aliens are in Babylon 5, particularly the Centauri,
right,
who are a kind of decadent older race.
Yeah.
Not quite humanoid,
yep,
but almost.
Yeah.
And
noteworthy differences in certain areas.
Yeah, basically their genitals are on tentacles.
Yes,
but they're trying to get back their old glory. They, the Narn or another species, were basically turned into slaves by the Centauri at one stage. So the Narn ambassador, forget his name.
Jakar.
Yeah, Jakar goes from being. I mean, all the ambassadors of Babylon 5 at the start, the two main ones, the Malari, the Centauri ambassador, and Jakar are just basically there having a good time. They're getting drunk and chatting up chicks, and Jakar in particular has a fetish for human females at the start.
Yep.
Story arc, as adversity hits him and as the series progresses, he becomes a very important leader in the history of his people.
Yep.
He has an epiphany and really does come to be what his species needs, and his species, the Narn, really do get hammered in various parts of this story. Their planet is bombarded from space.
Yeah,
mass driver bombardment from space, all these other things. And he becomes an incredibly charismatic leader from being this decadent and, from their point of view, perverted.
Right.
Ambassador.
Yeah.
And you've got those kind of story arcs where the character actors, and particularly Andre Casulas,
right,
the guy playing Jakar, he's working through a lot of makeup there, but he brings this incredible, vivid, nuanced character that is nuanced beyond anything you'll see in a Star Trek.
Yeah, Jakar is really almost, to some extent, one of the main character of the story to a large extent. Do you know the story about the actor who played him, who played Jakar, that he was actually one of these guys who's, you know, once he got into costume, he was the character. You couldn't talk to him about anything other than you were talking to Jakar until he got out of makeup.
Unfortunately, he died a few years ago, and one of the things said about him was that he really loved cigarettes.
Yes.
And unfortunately, he died of lung cancer, but apart from that, he was really a lovely guy.
Yeah, yeah. Peter Jurassic actually had this really nice interview about and talking about him, and just has really fond memories of the guy.
And he's good too, playing Malari as well. I mean, Malari's got this incredible story arc as well.
Yeah.
The Centauri ambassador, where he goes from being just basically a tired old man to getting a chance of basically his worst angels are given a voice. And the worst and most hateful and fearful things in him blossom and form an immense destructive force.
Right, and he actually starts out as, in opposition to Jakar at the very beginning, he starts out as a very likable old man. You really kind of, you can totally see this guy as like this every guy. And very friendly, it's like, I could hang out with this guy. But then he just goes down this rabbit hole startlingly rapidly of... I mean, ultimately, he manages to climb his way out of it, but it's just not a pretty thing to watch at all.
No, and the great thing I think the Babylon 5 brings is every character, every major character has a really interesting arc with a payoff.
Yes, yes.
They reward the actors for going through it, and there were immense problems with the studios. The budgets weren't very good. They never knew from 1 year to the next whether they'd be renewed and they could continue telling the story. In fact, season 4 was rushed through to be able to tell the story because they didn't think they were going to get a season 5.
Right. They actually shot the last episode of the series as part of season 4 because they weren't sure that, because they were literally negotiating whether they were going to have a fifth season with TNT. Straczynski was like on a daily basis.
But this series is important for a couple of reasons. It does show, it's the first series I think that shows that science fiction on television can be told with a grown-up complexity that Star Trek never really had. Star Trek was always about an idealized America, in a sense.
Yeah, I would agree.
And Babylon 5 is about the United Nations and the messy, angry, conflicting things that the real world brings to negotiations and wars and different conflicting belief systems, different conflicting needs for species and races. And it does have that wonderful complexity about it. One of the virtues of film, the thing has, of course, is they had Harlan Ellison as a creative consultant on the series as well.
Yes. That's always a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing in the sense that he kept them honest in a way. He kept the story, he helped keep, with Straczynski, he helped them keep story as paramount.
Right.
And they even, of course, they did have an actor from Star Trek in them as well, Walter Koenig.
Yep, Bester.
Playing Bester, the Psycop.
Yep.
And he did much.
He was the head of PsyCorps, right? Am I remembering that correct?
Yeah, he was. He was head of PsyCorps, and he did much better work here than he ever did on Star Trek. Was given the opportunity to do on Star Trek.
Right. Did you happen to catch the one where he was on and they give him a drug to suppress his psychic abilities while he's working with Garibaldi? I think they're hunting down a rogue Psy. I can't remember what the gimmick was, but what this plot line was. But the gimmick was they had to neutralize his Psy ability, so they give him a drug to suppress his Psy ability. And he just, it's a great episode because his character really changes a lot. He really, he's like, the guy's actually really got a sense of humor. He's actually a really funny guy once you get past the fact when he doesn't have these hideously powerful powers to fall back on.
Once you get past Walter Koenig's very bad toupee.
Yeah, that's true.
which I'm glad to see he has now jettisoned.
Oh, okay. He has.
He's embraced his skin, but I think that one of the interesting things, he's not a particularly tall man, so he's got that small man syndrome as a part of the character,
right?
Playing to the physicality that he's obviously has, but he's got that. It's like James Bond said in one of the James Bond novels: "It's the short people in the world that cause all the trouble." Now, I don't know how tall you are, Nick. I'm about 6 foot. Yeah. But I have seen people who are shorter who compensate for a perceived inferiority by having that over-aggression.
Yeah, we get that over here as well, yeah.
Yeah, so you do get a little bit of that. And I think that Koenig puts that into Bester. I don't know how much of it's in the writing, how much of it's into the actor. I know there was a little interaction on it. But it does come across really well. The main characters are interesting too. I mean, Sheridan and the cop guy that they've got played Jerry Doyle.
Yeah, I was going to say Jeffrey Doyle. It's Jerry Doyle, that's right.
Jerry Doyle, yeah. His character who's basically the police chief on the space station.
Basically channeling Bruce Willis, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was actually on an episode of Moonlighting because he looked a bit like Bruce Willis, playing a guy who looked a bit like Bruce Willis.
I didn't appreciate that.
Which is kind of an interesting thing, but yeah, he's the Bruce Willis playing Michael Garibaldi, the security officer, right. And you know, he's a reformed alcoholic, and he's made some mistakes in his career, and he's given a chance on that too.
Make a couple more mistakes over the course of the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice thing about this series, apart from the two captains, well, the three captains they have who are running the station. Everybody else fucks up in some way pretty well.
Right.
And has to come back from that as well. I mean, the doctor played by Richard Biggs gets a drug dependency as a part of his story arc as well.
Yep.
And
it's up home on the homeless section of the station, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And those kind of things where the really extraordinary strains the characters are under do have an effect on how the characters play out. It cracks open any weaknesses in them, and they've got to come back from that. So this is an incredibly complex TV series over the arc. I think that,
it's a lot more than that one sentence Wikipedia gave you about the show.
It is absolutely. IMDb, I think it was. But, one of the lovely things about it, of course, is that arc. And it's got a few. It's groundbreaking in other ways. All of the space scenes that were done CGI for the first time ever. And there's a progression from Series 1 to Series 5 on how good that CGI is. The first series, it's fairly primitive. It's about on line with an animatic from a not too good computer game, in a sense.
Right.
And
even the jump from the pilot to series one actually was noticeable, I felt.
Yeah. And it progresses from there. But as I said to you before, one of the other things is that the view screens they have on the station, the graphics on those improves a lot over the series as well. They start out looking like they're done with this Commodore 64 or an Amiga.
Right.
And then they do get better and better. So it's nice watching that too, because it shows that they're trying to improve each time as they get the new budgets and they get the new software. And this is right at the point where it starts getting viable to do computer graphics on a TV series.
The other part of that, just to jump in here, the other part of the graphics, computer graphics, I think is important too, is that they're used on one and a half of the alien species, whereas some of the other aliens, or all the rest of the aliens, are handled by practical effects. And they're seamless. I mean, there's not this jarring jump when you see one of the CGI aliens versus the practical effects aliens. You totally buy they're in the same universe. There's not this disconnect that you'd expect to see given the newness of the technology.
Yeah, and they very cleverly do it for the least humanoid of the aliens.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, the shadows and the aliens like that really, they're like giant black spider, scorpion
praying
kind of creatures.
Mantis things, yeah.
Praying mantis-y things, and they're very kind of, they set off an instinctive revulsion.
Yes.
When you see them, because of that kind of insectoid thing. And one of the other things about the series that's really good is it's the first TV series that really embraced the burgeoning internet. At the time, it was Usenet and the Usenet groups. And Babylon 5 was very active on this. Straczynski was on there at times. A number of other people were as well. They had an incredibly active fan community on Usenet. And that was a channel for Straczynski to talk to his audience.
Yeah, the first really time to. I mean, today you see showrunners interacting with the fans, but this was really the first time where you saw that happening on a regular basis. It really was all the time.
Absolutely, that shows a lot of prescience and a lot of presence too. I mean, it wasn't something that cost them much money at the time to do. They just had to go on Usenet and put things through, chuck a couple of teasers in there, build the fan base. Respect the fan base as well.
Yep.
And I remember I was at Westercon in 98, and Straczynski was there, and he was shown a lot of respect by science fiction fans, not only the media fans, but because of the quality of the writing he was doing, the literary science fiction fans were really respectful and embraced him as a member of the community.
Right, yeah. And rightfully so, I would say.
Absolutely, and he's gone on from strength to strength too. Straczynski, he wrote comics for a few years as well, which is kind of cool.
Yep,
Just taking a look at, he did the screenplay.
Comic strips, Rising Stars and Midnight Nation were two. I highly recommend it. If you like Straczynski's writing, check those out. Both outstanding comic book series. But anyway, go ahead.
And also did the screenplay for Changeling, that movie that Clint Eastwood did with Angelina Jolie.
Oh, okay.
He did that. Let me just see what else he's done. He's done a whole bunch of other... There's some things he's done recently that I really want to touch on just to show that he's got what he deserves here. And, of course, because his IMDb page is just so long, it's a little hard to find. Okay, here we go. We're going to go over to IMDb and just see. Because I know there is something that he did recently that I really wanted to mention. He actually worked on Thor. He did a little bit of. He did the story that for the Thor recently.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. Ninja Assassin. He did the screenplay for that as well. Underworld Awakening. So yeah, basically, he's still got his finger in all the pies there.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I like Thor as a movie a lot. Actually, the more it's funny. I kind of dodged it at the time because I was never a big fan. My wife and I were not big fans of the character, but. As I said after seeing the movie to Diane, if the character of the comic were like this, I'd have owned every issue of it. I really like that movie the more I watch it.
Well, that's it. If you want a really kind of big, hulky, godlike actor, you've got to go to an Australian these days. Chris Hemsworth. He grew up about 60...
I was not aware.
Yeah, he grew up about 60 kilometers away from here down on Phillip Island. Surfing in the ocean, yeah.
I got the surfer vibe out of him then.
he's a good actor. I think he's one of those actors who isn't relying on his looks particularly. And yeah. I think that he did learn a lot working with people like Brenner and Hopkins on Thor, and has really embraced his career as an actor rather than as a star, which is kind of interesting. So when his looks fade, you're still going to see him as a jobbing actor, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the story was partly written by Straczynski. But Babylon 5, getting back to Babylon 5 for a minute, they did do another series afterwards called Crusade, which wasn't very successful because I think that the big part of that universe was told in Babylon 5.
Right, yeah. I think Straczynski's line was, the mistake with Crusade is you don't do a series where people know how it's going to end or something like that.
Yeah. And they did a couple of Lost Tales videos and things like that on very small budgets.
Yeah, the Lost Tales is interesting because that came out in 2007. I mean, that's a fairly recent thing. Surprisingly recent given the...
Yeah, and there are a couple of TV movies in between as well. So,
yep.
But I think you've got to go back to that core 5 years. I think that's where the real story is. And from a storytelling point of view, leaving aside the fact that the special effects are now a bit quaint, and there were times when some of the acting wasn't quite where you'd like it to be for that kind of a production, I think that story arc is great, and the universe creates a sense of place on that space station that hasn't really been matched anywhere else in science fiction television since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, the whole universe just is so brilliantly constructed, and clearly, you know, there's a clear, you know, Straczynski knew what the story was. He knew where everything was going to land, more or less, and you really feel that in the whole 5 year arc. It's clear that this was, like I said before, and Straczynski described as a 110 chapter novel. It really comes across like that very clearly.
It's a very textured universe and nuanced, and it's from a very humanist point of view as well. Even though it does address religious issues at times, it does it from a neutral viewpoint,
right,
which is kind of interesting as well, because even though there is mysticism among certain races, and there are some implications that some forms of prophecy do work,
right,
they respect but don't endorse any particular system.
Really exist,
which I kind of like as well. You've got to kind of address that elephant in the room of belief systems,
right?
But I think they do it in a way that is very equitable to all of them.
Yes,
which is kind of cool, and they don't assume the way they do perhaps in Star Trek that most. Yeah, that even that there's no poverty and things like that. There's poverty in this universe.
Right.
There's disadvantage. There's dysfunction and things like that. And they do address that. And even on a space station like Babylon 5, they've got slums and they've got criminals and they've got gangs and criminal organizations and things like that. All that stuff that you don't get in very much in a Star Trek universe.
Yeah. Yeah, the other different that reminded me of something else that really that stands out from Star Trek as well is the in Star Trek you had this universe where you have the Federation and basically everyone's at the Federation's level of technology except for the cliche Trelane, Organians, Metron, Q. Yeah, and so there's this the other tech level is basically so it's like a Clark's line. It's so powerful. It's effectively the science is so advanced. It's effectively magic. Whereas in Babylon 5, the thing that I thought was really impressive too is that the races, like you said, you know, Earth's kind of the newcomer here, and some of the races take offense at that actually, by the way, which is neat. But the Narns are sort of at our level. But then you have the Centauri, who've been, they've been around a little longer, but they're still level. But then you have the Minbari; they've got 10,000 years on us, and it's pretty clear technologically that they do. There's one point where Delenn pulls out some bit, and I think the pilot a ring, and just starts altering the gravity in a room on somebody. And it's like whoa! It's like clear. It's not everyone's at the same play field. And then when you get to the Vorlons, and you know the Vorlons have infinity effectively years on everyone, and they're not afraid to show it when things start getting ugly, and you realize, it was just really neat to see that spread of tech levels. Where so you did have these, these galactics where they had these god level powers, but you had some nice spread in between with the Narns, the Minbari at 10,000 years above us, and the Centauri who even though they had only a few thousand years on us, they clearly had been around the block more, and their technology kind of showed it a little.
Yeah, they do. They do have a universe that's a very dangerous but wonderful place.
Yes.
Which is kind of nice about it as well. So I don't think we can do anything more except suggest that people revisit it if they've got a ton of time on their hands.
Right. Yep.
And it is worthy of consideration. I think it's really one of those series that, even though it was dismissed by a lot of people, particularly Trekkies at the time,
right,
really did try within the limitations that were imposed upon it by technology, by studios, by the spirit of the times, even,
right.
really did try to tell a wider story and a complex story with recognition to the failings and frailties of being a person.
Yep.
So that's about it for that one. So Babylon 5, I think we got a recommendation there from us.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm going to do the feedback a bit later because you obviously can't hear it when we're talking via Skype, so I'll do the feedback as a standalone. But again, do your plug, please, Nick.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks for very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure. My site is Fantastic Television, all one word, .wordpress.com, and you can come and see my semi-coherent ramblings about genre television.
Just like my semi-coherent ramblings here. But, yeah, I definitely want to get you on again if you're okay to. I mean, I'm not sure when, but we will get you back to talk about some other stuff.
Absolutely. I'd love to be on.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Nick, and I'll be back after another break with some feedback, which we do have a chunk of.
Cool.
Okay, now is the time for the feedback. And the first one we've got is, of course, Richard from Wichita, who's reliable and always has something interesting to say, so I'll play his one and do a little bit of chat about it afterwards.
Terry, this is Richard from Wichita, wanting to call in with some comments on the last two episodes of the Martian Drive-In podcast. Finally caught up and definitely have some thoughts on the recent movies you talked about. First and foremost, though, I want to say thank you for including a link a while back, back in October, I guess it was, and I don't think I acknowledged the fact that you included a link on your marsdrivein.blogspot.com site to my blog, Monster Movie Kid. Appreciate the shout out there and your references to your number 7 podcast. So thank you very much for that. I want to talk about the last two episodes, but I'm going to go ahead and start with episode 9, The Island of Lost Souls and Black Sabbath. Island of Lost Souls, you know, a little bit of tidbit here on the States, because I don't really think you talked about this too much. Island of Lost Souls is one of the, for many years, is one of the hardest movies to find that often gets considered to be a universal horror classic, of which it is not. It was actually done by Paramount Studios, but got licensed out to Universal in the 1950s for inclusion in Universal's Shock Theater package that was syndicated to television stations. It was included in the Universal Horror Classics VHS collection because, again, it was still licensed out. But that licensing apparently has ended, and for many years the movie was not available on DVD, despite the fact that it was one of the first films from the horror genre that was announced to be released on DVD. It never happened. With the release of the Criterion Collections version, we finally have a wonderful copy available. So I really enjoyed hearing you talk about that. It's been a movie that, you know, one of my favorites from that era. It's not even one that, it doesn't get played a lot on television. I think it is literally played twice in the last 10 years on Turner Classic Movies. So very glad that you've talked about this one. It's a movie I think everyone knows about. This, it has always been hard to find and not something played very often on television. Black Sabbath. Now, it's been quite a few years since I've seen Black Sabbath, but it did bring to mind that, you know, Boris Karloff, towards the latter half of his career, of which this is in the last 10 years, less than 10 years that he was alive, you know, he didn't do some of the best work in the last 10 years. This is probably one of his better films. On another podcast I listened to, Dread Media, they had a review of The Monster Club with Vincent Price, which is not one of Vincent Price's best. But when I was talking on that show, I made reference to the fact that there are some of these great horror actors that just the presence of them in the film will make a film watchable, Vincent Price being one of them. Boris Karloff is another. Now, just having Boris Karloff in a movie doesn't necessarily guarantee it to be watchable. It doesn't guarantee it to be a good movie, but it's always going to make it watchable because Boris Karloff just has a presence on screen that I think, you know, kind of demands your attention. And even if he's just sitting there talking, he had a certain way about him. Black Sabbath, I know there's a couple different versions of this out on video. I think the U.S. version is different than the European version. Been a few years since I've seen it. You've kind of brought that film back to the forefront of my mind. I've got a long list of movies to watch, but every now and then I will just randomly pick up an old title that I've seen, and I think this one might get bumped to the top of the stack as we go into the weekend. So I love a good anthology film, and again, it's got Boris Karloff in it. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the year of the Sex Olympics, which you covered in Episode 8. I'll be honest with you. When I first saw the title, I was like, what did Terry pick out this time? But man, a really good film. You know, so much to talk about. I've decided I'm going to write about it in my blog, but some of the things I just want to touch here real quick. You know, the BBC is notorious for throwing so many of those movies away. And the fact that we even have this, to watch in any form is in itself amazing. It comes from that same time period, those first six seasons of Doctor Who from 1963 to 1969. So many of those episodes are lost because they just threw away the tapes, wiped them clean. And the only reason we have some of those lost episodes today is because they were found in other countries. And a lot of some of the early 1970s Doctor Who episodes that were in color now exist only in black and white. So the fact that this exists only in black and white, I'm totally familiar with the stupidity behind the BBC's decision to do that. There is technology, I don't fully understand it, that they can restore color to some film footage if it was originally, when it was copied over from color. I don't know. They've been doing it on Doctor Who for a while. So there is a technology out there where I believe they could restore the color to this. It's very costly and time-consuming, and so we'll probably never see that happen to this, but there is always a chance that a color print could surface somewhere as well. Probably not, because it's such a lesser-known title, but the chance is out there. Thank you for directing us to YouTube. I watched it this morning as I'm calling here. It's been kind of a slow day at work, so I had this going on and watching it, and it's got a lot of crazy ideas at the time that are now come reality. It's a little tough to make it through the production quality, you know, again, very reminiscent of Doctor Who of that era, so you've got to be very forgiving, but it's well worth the watch. And, you know, American television, for example, I think is probably the most abysmal that we have in the world that we're creating. When a show like Here Comes Honey Boo Boo is one of the top watched shows on American television, essentially it's a family of rednecks with a little girl that they have basically sold her soul so they can make money off of essentially people laughing at them. I mean, that's the harsh reality behind that. It's really kind of sick, and it's the reason why I don't watch hardly any television today, is that I watch older programs when we actually had real television programs that had scripts and direction and wasn't that four-letter word called reality. So with that, thank you for bringing that to our attention, and that's exactly why your podcasts are a favorite of mine, because you don't pick all the time mainstream titles. You go for some of those lesser-known titles. Now, I'll be honest with you, Just Imagine didn't necessarily capture my attention, but the year of the Sex Olympics did. So, with that, I just want to say thank you for doing what you're doing. I've got one episode of Paleo Cinema to watch, so as I watch that, if I have any comments, I'll call in and let you know what I think about that. But if not, just know that I'm listening to all the shows, loving what you do, and take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, Richard. Reality TV, it's a problem, isn't it? The TV I tend to be scripted TV, and I'm very fond of that, particularly genre stuff. But I do like a good, strong storyline. I do like the idea of writers putting something together, and rather than having the freak show element of a number of reality TV shows like the one you mentioned. Having said that, though, I do like things like American Pickers and shows like that, where people are going out and finding junk and making money out of it. I find those very attractive because it's something I've done myself to an extent. And the characters are likable, whether they're really like that in reality or not's another matter. And how much of it's generated by the production and how much of it's natural is up for grabs. But I think it's fairly harmless, and I kind of do like to see what kind of junk people pick up and what they're worth and the way people perceive stuff. In a sense, it's a little bit of a parallel to paleo cinema, that kind of show, where people buying old stuff's a bit like people watching old stuff, having that sense of history and putting it in context and putting a value on it. I kind of like that kind of show. But having said that, scripted television is always much more interesting. I love good acting, and you can only get that in scripted television. You don't get that from some idiot who wants to be famous for being famous, or a family of idiots who want to be famous for being famous. So I totally agree with that. On the things I've picked, I kind of like them. Even Just Imagine I liked, because it was very early in the sound days, and I like having something there where I can say, right, it is what it is. It's a dumb little comedy set in 50 years in the future at the time. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's got a lot of things that have dated horribly, but it does show you that people were thinking about the future even in the past, and even if it was done haphazardly, really, they did have some nice set designs and imaginative stuff in there. And I value it for what it was. But then we come along with something like The Island of Lost Souls, which is a classic, and among Lawton's best early roles, which I really appreciated too. And again, it comes back to that trope of really good acting, and Charles Lawton in that film is very, very good. Karloff, he didn't do a lot of good stuff towards the end. I mean, of course, you've got Targets that he did with Bogdanovich. Yeah, I believe it was Bogdanovich. Which played to the persona of Boris Karloff, but putting it in a real-world context. I think that was a really smart move. And it does show Karloff as an actor. I mean, you look through the career of Boris Karloff, there are any number of films where you can see the kind of exceptional actor that he was, playing very dark roles at times, sometimes playing the victim, sometimes playing the oppressor. But one way or the other, really interesting guy. And one of the things I really do like finding on YouTube, there's a version of him doing the Peppermint Twist with Joey D and the Starlighters in the early 1960s, singing a pop song. And I kind of like that too. I like the fact that he played around with his own persona to that extent as well. So, yeah, Boris, fantastic guy there. You're at the Sex Olympics. I like the fact that it did predict reality television. I think that even if it is, like you said, a bit Doctor Who-y and a little dated and a little bit clumsy in some parts, I think telling those stories was a good thing to do. And finding something that different for television was a good thing to do as well. Failed experiments often lead to successful experiments. You've got to have a couple of things that try something out. People watch it and learn from it and then do something that does work. And I think that that's the kind of show that is that kind of fertilizes the ground for things that follow, and in that it's worth valuing and realizing that it is an important piece of television history. But thanks again, Richard, and again, anytime you want to kind of drop me a line, very happy to do so. And I'm glad you've got a job where occasionally it doesn't get busy and you can watch cool stuff on YouTube. That's about it for the feedback, and we've gone almost an hour and a half on this episode of Martian Drive-In Podcast, not that that matters very much. Anyway, if anybody else wants to be on the show and thinks they can have a chat and have something fruitful to say, always happy to hear you out and then go and do it. Feedback you can provide as the usual means, either at the website marsdrivein.blogspot.com. You can even leave voicemails there, which is kind of cool. Or you can contact me via cultguru@gmail.com. Always happy to do that one as well. Enjoy your movie watching and your TV watching in the meantime. I'm going to be back in 4 weeks with another episode, and a lot more fun and games will ensue. Hope you enjoyed this one. And take care of yourself and watch the skies. Bye.